This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. On his way out the door, after losing re-election last month, Kentucky Governor Matt Bevin handed out hundreds of pardons and sentence commutations, some of which have shocked victims' families and local prosecutors, killers, rapists, drug dealers, now set to walk free. We start the Friday News Review with Courier-Journal reporters Joe Sonka and Andrew Wolfson, who join us on the phone. Joe, welcome to you.
Thanks, Michael.
And Andy, a welcome to you for joining us for the first time.
Thanks.
Matt Bevin can rot in hell. Those are the words of Melinda Mills, the sister of Donald Mills, who was killed inside his home in the small Kentucky town of Scalf in eastern Kentucky. One of the men convicted in Donald Mills's death is Patrick Baker, who received one of these controversial pardons from the former governor. This case involves multiple convictions, but only Baker was pardoned. His family hosted a campaign fundraiser for Bevin last year. Let's talk about this one first. Andy, what do you know?
The fundraiser at the home of the brother and sister-in-law of the offender raised, I think, $21,500 to retire a campaign debt from Bevin's 2015 election.
Okay, and Andy, what is the nature of this crime that we're talking about, the death of Donald Mills?
Mills was killed inside his own home in a home invasion. The defendants, including Baker, impersonated police officers to get in the door. And then during a struggle, the victim was killed. And Baker was convicted of reckless homicide and robbery and some other offenses.
And if I understand correctly, Andy, two others were convicted in this case, but only Patrick Baker, whose family raised money for the outgoing governor, received a pardon?
Right. The two others are still in prison, and their lawyers told us this week that they are seriously aggrieved by that, and that the only explanation is that that Baker had money or access to money, and that that's why he was pardoned.
Joe Sonka, also a reporter with the Courier-Journal, who's on the line with us as well. Those words, "Matt Bevin can rot in hell," are on the front page of the print edition of the Courier-Journal today. The words of Melinda Mills, the sister of Donald Mills. What can you tell us about the family's reaction?
Well, the family is, of course, furious. They believe that this was basically the fundraiser basically served as a bribe to Matt Bevin in order to purchase the pardon. And that's basically what two Democratic state legislators want to investigate. They're calling on the Attorney General-elect, Daniel Cameron, who will take office next week, to appoint a special independent prosecutor to look into whether Matt Bevin acted improperly and broke any state or federal statutes when he issued that pardon, whether he did that in order to receive some kind of personal benefit or favor. And they cited a couple state and federal statutes that they think might apply. So they're asking Cameron to appoint that prosecutor investigative team to look into that issue.
And Joe, you are in Frankfurt currently, where this news conference just took place this morning with those state lawmakers calling for this. Did we hear it all yet from Attorney General-elect Daniel Cameron?
He gave a statement that did not address whether his office would investigate. He did say in a statement that he stands with prosecutors and he respects the opinion of juries, but he has not specifically come out and criticized any specific pardons or said that he's going to investigate the circumstances of any pardons yet.
There were some really contrasting images provided by the Courier-Journal in their coverage of this particular pardon, one showing the stately house of the Baker family that contributed this campaign fund to Matt Bevin, and then sort of the downtrodden home of the Mills. And what can you tell us a little bit, Andrew, about that part of Kentucky and these contrasts? I know that the town of Scalf and the city of Corbin are not that far apart.
I didn't go there. Another reporter did, so I can't describe them. But generally, there's in most eastern Kentucky counties, there's a wide contrast between the affluent and the poor, and that most people tend to be in the latter group.
These pardons include other killers and violent criminals. Some are local to northern Kentucky in our listening area here, and they are causing outrage seemingly across party lines. Joe, Kenton County State Senator Chris McDaniel, whose district includes Covington, he's a Republican like Bevin. He said yesterday, Thursday, that he wants to change the state constitution. Can you tell us anything about that?
Yeah, he says he's going to introduce legislation next month, which would change the constitution, basically prohibiting a governor from issuing pardons right on his way out the door at the very end of his term. The two legislators who called for the independent prosecutor, they were a little skeptical of wanting to change the constitution, but just because one governor abused that power or allegedly abused that power. But you are seeing bipartisan criticism of what the governor has done. You have a Republican prosecutor up there in northern Kentucky, Rob Sanders. You have the Republican prosecutor in Knox County in the Baker case, Mr. Steele. So behind the scenes right now at the moment, you have Republican legislators who are also very disturbed by some of these pardons and are questioning those.
I think the idea behind that bill, and it's kind of ingenious, is that a lame duck governor would not be permitted to issue pardons, and they would have to do it when there would still be political consequences from issuing them, which could make them much more cautious in doing so.
That's correct. And Joe, what you were just saying about some of the I guess behind the scenes chatter, I believe I saw a tweet from State Senator Whitney Westerfield from Hopkinsville in the southern part of the state who said that they're talking about it, but I didn't see a whole lot of specifics about what he was saying. Are you getting any general feel for what these lawmakers are talking about when they're not talking to us in the press?
Well, I can say that I haven't seen anyone publicly defend the pardons, which might be a sign at this point. I think a lot of legislators that Republican legislators who used to butt heads with Bevin were kind of kept their criticisms of him silent. And I think we might see whether, since he's out of office, more people actually step out and criticize Bevin for these pardons, since they're not really fearing any retribution from him at this point. But the Republicans in the Senate, their caucus did have a retreat, and we know that pardons were a big topic of conversation. We just don't know what specifically those were yet. Chris McDaniel is a Republican. He was at that retreat. So he was the one that announced yesterday that he's going to attempt that constitutional amendment. So that was at least one focus of it. And they've also, McDaniel and McGarvey and Harris today, when they were talking about the idea of an independent prosecutor, they said they might be open to some provisions where if the governor does issue a pardon, they have to provide advance notice to the victims of the crime, to the prosecutors of the crime, instead of the way Bevin did it, where he surprised everyone and all of these prosecutors and families of the victims had no idea it was coming. So that may be one other area of legislation that people look at.
It seemed to catch the prosecutors off guard pretty significantly. Rob Sanders, the Kenton County Commonwealth's attorney, who's very active on social media, was very upset about one local murder case that we're going to talk about in a moment. But then after expressing outrage about that, this local child rape case came out as well. And we saw a post from Rob Sanders, how many more are coming? So it does seem very surprising. We're going to talk a little bit about those cases coming up. As you mentioned, Joe, Rob Sanders and other prosecutors across the state are upset. We saw a tweet from Ohio Republican Attorney General Dave Yost. He posted to Twitter, quote, "Killers and rapists and more, the pardon power is extraordinary for compelling circumstances. The wholesale junking of the hard work of juries, prosecutors, and judges is troubling." But we also heard from Matt Bevin, So before we get into some of those local cases that involve the partner commutation, I want to note that Bevin offered a comment to the Washington Post, quote, "I'm a big believer in second chances. I think this is a nation that was founded on the concept of redemption and second chances and new pages in life." He goes on to say, "If there has been a change and there is no further value that comes for the individual, for society, for the victims, for anybody, if a person continues to stay in, then that's when somebody should be considered for a commutation or a pardon." Andy,
let me say in Bevin's defense that some of these pardons were issued to offenders who may have been wrongfully convicted, and hundreds of them were issued to drug offenders, and both Republicans and Democrats over the last 2 years have expressed an interest in reducing drug sentences and reducing prison overcrowding. So many of these may have been justified, although some appear not to have been.
That seems to be what the analysis is. There's more than 400 pardons or commutations overall. And while it's not uncommon for outgoing executives in the government with this authority to exercise it, and often it's controversial in one way or another or polarizing in another way, sometimes it's also celebrated as an example of another tool of justice that can be deployed. Joe, I'm wondering if there's any indication of what these particular pardons of the more violent criminals may do to Bevin's legacy, which, while he was unpopular enough to lose re-election last month, he was still seemingly relatively popular with prominent Republicans, particularly some lawmakers and other politicians around the state. What does this do to him now?
Well, I think what it does is a lot of people who are on the fence about Bevin or weren't very fond of him but didn't publicly criticize him are. I think a lot of those people are going to come out of the woodwork, and this is really going to be kind of the defining action that they'll remember Bevin for. Like in towns like Hopkinsville, Kentucky, where there was a very controversial pardon, towns like Corbin, up in Kenton County, and the Mike, the child rape case that you have there. I think those are some of the pardons, some of the actions of Bevin that I think people might remember him for, especially in those communities where those crimes, those murders or rapes or other horrible crimes were so vivid in people's memories that I think an action like this people will always remember in those towns.
I personally
I guess if there was any speculation that Bevin might run for future office, such as the U.S. Senate, that's probably over now. I think Joe is our political expert, but he might have more thoughts on that.
I could see these being used in campaign ads, Joe.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, next year seems like a stretch, but I assume that Matt Bevin's not done with politics. But this, whenever he comes back and makes that attempt again, if he does, I'm quite certain that several of these are going to come up.
I heard you reference the child rape case in Kenton County, Joe. I personally wrote a story about this man just over a year ago, and I want to read a piece of that article. It's from August of 2018. Quote, "A man was sentenced to 23 years in prison after being convicted of first-degree rape, first-degree sodomy, and first-degree sexual abuse. 40-year-old Micah Shettle was arrested in September 2016 after an investigation by the Erlanger Police Department. A middle school student reported that she had been sexually assaulted by Shettle beginning when she was 9. According to the Kenton County Commonwealth's Attorney's Office, the victim was interviewed in the Northern Kentucky Children's Advocacy Center, where she described in details the sexual assaults." Okay, so that was just over a year ago. Shettle received a sentence of 23 years in prison. It's 15 months later, and Shettle received a full pardon. Prosecutor Rob Sanders said Shettle won't even have to register as a sex offender. Is this similar to any other cases of these pardons?
There was one that was somewhat similar to that in Hopkinsville, where a group of kids, one in particular, sodomized a 15-year-old when he was passed out and gave him really horrific injuries. And that person received a long sentence, and Bevin also pardoned him. I know in the Northern Kentucky case in Kenton County, Bevin basically said, "I don't believe the evidence. I don't believe he did it." In some of these other cases, Bevin has pardoned people like there were a couple of drunk drivers that hit a driver and killed people. And he talks about, well, I'm going to condition this pardon that you are going to talk to different groups and warn them about, you know, the dangers of drunk driving. A lot of the other pardons are saying that they've found God and they've reformed themselves, and I don't think it serves any purpose for them to be in jail anymore. There were several that were convicted of killing babies. One threw her child in a cesspool right after she was born. Another violently shook a 6-week-old kid baby and killed it. And Bevin was talking about redemption and not serving any purpose for that person to still be in jail. So yeah, a lot of these are controversial in that nature.
I saw an interesting comment on social media from just a listener or a reader. And we remember the very controversial statement that Governor Matt Bevin made earlier this year during the large teacher protest in Frankfurt, where he spoke to the media as that day was winding down and suggested that it was possible somewhere in Kentucky a child had been molested because they weren't at school, because the schools had been shut down, because the teachers were in Frankfurt protesting over proposed changes to their retirement. And now here he is leaving office and offering full pardons to people who have sexually abused or killed children. Has there been any significant reaction to that particular angle to this?
There definitely has been. And what's missing here is of course, Matt Bevin's explanations. I mean, he wrote them in the pardons and commutations, but he hasn't returned calls from us. He did call back a Washington Post reporter and left a voicemail. But if Matt Bevin would like to, you know, defend himself and explain some of these pardons and commutation, he's more than welcome to join the public debate. But right now, a lot of people are absolutely furious at about the dozen or so that seem questionable at this point.
I want to note that one of the other local cases involved convicted murderer Gregory Wilson, who in 1987 kidnapped, raped, and murdered a woman named Deborah Pooley. She worked at the old Barleycorns on the Newport Riverfront that used to be there. Bevin commuted Wilson's death sentence to life imprisonment and made him eligible for parole. That really upset Rob Sanders as well. This case was prosecuted in Kenton County. The governor said that Wilson had an inadequate defense, including attorneys who had never tried a felony case. And you can read more about these specific pardons in the exhaustive reporting by Joe Sonka and Andy Wolfson at the Courier Journal. I want to ask both of you, and Andy, I'll start with you. While working on this report, what did you learn about the pardon process?
I learned that the only requirement under the Constitution is that the governor has to give an explanation for each pardon and commutation, and that must be kept available to the public. Although in some of these, there's no explanation given, and it's not clear yet whether that's because they haven't been posted yet. But the documents that are posted don't give an explanation. That includes the Christian County case that Joe mentioned.
That's where Hopkinsville is, Christian County, down on
right,
the Tennessee
right.
border. Joe, what about you? Did you learn anything you didn't know about this process?
Well, it seems like the constitutional experts in Kentucky say that a lot of people initially were saying, like, can these pardons be rescinded? Can the incoming Governor Beshear do anything? And really, the answer to that question is no. Once the pardon's out there, you can't pull it back. We'll see if there's a special prosecutor that's looking into other actions around those pardons when there was improper political favors happening. But as far as the pardons that have been issued, once you issue those, you can't really take that back.
Joe and Andy, before I let you all go, Joe, can you give us an update on the situation involving the Kentucky State Board of Education and the ouster of Education Commissioner Wayne Lewis?
Yes. Well, Andy Beshear, one of the main promises of his campaign was that he was going to, on his first week or his first day, he sometimes said, he was going to issue an executive order basically eliminating and restructuring the State Board of Education, putting new members on there, and firing Education Commissioner Wayne Lewis. Wayne Lewis was kind of a lightning bolt. He took tons of criticism over his stances toward public education, his support for taking over Jefferson County Public Schools in Louisville, was seen as kind of an enemy of public school teachers who were protesting Matt Bevin and his policies. So Bashir came in and that was actually his first executive order, was to do so. And though the members who were sacked sued Bashir right away to try to keep that position, ultimately the judge decided that the new board could meet. And yesterday they did exactly what Bashir wanted, and they forced Lewis out. So there will be a new education commissioner very soon.
We'll continue to follow that. From the Courier-Journal, reporters Joe Sonka and Andrew Wolfson joining us on the phone. Thanks to both of you for being here.
Thank you.
Thanks, Michael.
And this is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. The Friday News Review continues now with WVXU reporters Ann Thompson. Hi, Ann.
Hi, Michael.
Ambriel Crutchfield. Hi, Ambriel.
Hello.
And Tana Weingartner. Hi, Tana.
Bonjour.
Let's start with you, Ann. We have an update to this ongoing case involving the death of teenager Kyle Plush, who we recall suffocated inside of a vehicle at his high school. And what's the latest on this?
So the incident happened in April of 2018. The reason we were in court yesterday is because the parents, after not getting anywhere with the city, had filed a lawsuit, and the city has requested that the lawsuit be dismissed. So this was a hearing about whether or not it should be dismissed. And this was before Hamilton County Judge Robert Ruhlman. And the assistant city solicitor, speaking for the city, says that the five employees named in the lawsuit, that would be the former city manager, two police officers, and two dispatchers, were not reckless. As the lawsuit suggests, they may have been negligent, but they were not reckless. And so Peter Stackpole says, listen, here's what happened. The first dispatcher listened to the call, called back, got voicemail, didn't know there was 80 pounds of pressure on his neck in the car, so didn't know the urgency. Second dispatcher thought Kyle was deaf because he wasn't responding to her questions. She activated the TTY system for the hearing impaired, and that distorted the call. So then she didn't hear him give a description of the vehicle or say, if, you know, I probably don't have much time left, so please tell my mom that I love her if I die. He says police were on the scene in 3 minutes. They thought they were looking for a female. Nobody was flagging them down once they got to Seven Hills. But the parent's attorney, Al Gerhardstein, says, hey, wait a minute. He later told the media this was a huge combination of outrageous errors. He says dispatchers should have known the urgency and they should have sent EMS because they have automatic vehicle locator technology where the police do not. I recently asked Jay Hanselman, my coworker, about this, and he says, yeah, police don't have it yet. That would be because of the cost, more likely than not. And at the time, they delayed the dispatcher making the CAD entry for the call for 7 minutes. The city, he says, has known about problems with the 911 system for years and failed to address them. And he says that the Plushes just want to get to the bottom of how their son died and how to prevent this tragedy from happening again.
Well, we'll continue to follow that story, Ann. Thanks for that update.
So January 22nd is when the judge says that he will make a decision.
Ambriel Crutchfield from WVXU, your story this week that we're talking about involves the Stand Your Ground law and the way that black gun owners feel about it. Mm-hmm. What can you tell us?
Yeah, so basically right now in Ohio, say I live in my apartment and you enter and you startle me maybe, I can shoot you and say, hey, I was scared as self-defense. But now they're introducing a bill that would make it to where if I'm in a public place and you scare me and I shoot you, say, for example, then I can claim stand your ground without retreating. So that means I don't have to try to get away from you in any case. And so I spoke to pro Second Amendment black people, gun owners, and they felt like this would be something that would harm them directly. A national research expert that I spoke to also said that the way that the law is adjudicated nationally, it doesn't shake out the same for people of color as well as women.
Did you learn anything that was surprising?
Yeah, I mean, one thing that's very interesting is that the Castle Doctrine, which is what Stand Your Ground comes from, that's been American law since the beginning of time. And so when we think about that and think about who was able to own guns, it was white men that owned property. And so that also kind of makes us, okay, how do we understand how this law is applied today and how we discuss this today? And I will say that the guy I spoke to that was in support of Stand Your Ground said that he thinks it'll benefit women and people of color. So,
and you can read that story at WVXU.org. Tana Weingartner, we will go to your alma mater next, Miami University.
graduate school, sure.
Well, sure, one of them. Well, you're very educated, lots of alma maters. But the school is going to be honoring some of the connections to the Freedom Summer, which we've talked about frequently on this program.
Right. So they have a memorial for Freedom Summer, specifically James Chaney, Andrew Goodman, and Michael Schwerner, who were on Miami's campus for training in 64 and were killed shortly thereafter. After returning to Mississippi. Now student government said, we'd like there to be some lounge spaces in dorms on Western campus that also honor these three civil rights workers so that students, you know, it's not a memorial they just walk by. There will be plaques in the lounge areas detailing who these people were in Miami's connection with the civil rights movement. And today, this morning, the Board of Trustees approved that unanimously, so the signage will go up in the spring.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah, and it was brought forward by student government. And, you know, jumped through all the hurdles. So it should be good to go.
Okay. Well, we'll be up there to see that soon, I hope. My thanks to Ann Thompson, Tana Weingartner, and Ambriel Crutchfield. Did any of you get Garth Brooks tickets this morning?
You know, Jay did.
Jay Hanselman?
He did get them.
He was sitting by his computer counting down when he was going to be up.
I'm pretty sure he was on the clock this morning. Ambriel's looking at me like, why would you ask if I got Garth Brooks tickets?
I don't even know who that is.
Oh, my gosh. Ambriel.
I have animal news.
Oh, you do?
Yesterday was Inanna's birthday. They're still watching to see if the polar bear is pregnant. So happy birthday, Inanna. And Fiona can be outside up until 40-degree weather for those of you that need to go see your princess.
So she's still hanging out.
Yeah.
I bet she got Garth Brooks tickets.
I feel like as much reporting as you've done on the zoo, your name deserves to be on a plaque someplace.
Someday, the Tana Weingartner Hippo Dome. That'll be a lot of fun. Anyway, Garth Brooks tickets sold out in 75 minutes this morning.
Right.
So he's got lots of friends in these low places here. So
thanks,
Ann, Tana, Ambriel. We appreciate that very much. Okay, up next, we talk to the Associated Press editor overseeing national politics. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition On Demand. Did you know you can have the show delivered straight to your smartphone every day? Just go to your favorite podcast listening app, search Cincinnati Edition, and subscribe. You'll be able to keep up with all our great conversations with newsmakers, public officials, and other interesting people from the greater Cincinnati region and beyond on the go, anytime, anywhere. It's great for those days you can't tune in to catch us live. Weekdays at noon on 91.7 WVXU. And this is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. We conclude the Friday news review with a conversation we recorded last month while Associated Press editor overseeing national politics Stephen Sloan was in town. He was speaking at Northern Kentucky University. And joining us now is Associated Press national political editor Stephen Sloan. Stephen, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me. Great to be here.
And you're in town because of a trip to Northern Kentucky University. And so you've spent some time speaking to students, I imagine. And I'm wondering what you're gathering as a professional journalist in a management position at a legacy news agency, what you're hearing from young people about how they consume the news.
Well, I think they're avid consumers of news. I think that they really know what's going on and can really be articulate in talking about the issues of the day. I think one of the things that surprises me is, and it shouldn't surprise me, it makes me seem really old here, but what surprises me is where they're getting their news. Obviously, I've known that social media is powerful, but I think we're seeing young people really getting their news on Reddit. A student told me this morning that that was one of his primary news sources. I asked for a show of hands of, you know, does anybody just wake up in the morning and read the New York Times or the Washington Post? And that didn't. It was not a majority vote, let's just say. I think it's really instructive. I think that they are exposed to so much information, but it does kind of underscore concerns about, you know, where some of that information is coming from, right?
Yeah. And so what are their views on the media today or how they consume the news? How is that reflective of society in general?
Well, you know, I think kind of as I've come along, I always have like my time that I like read the news. And, you know, I was telling them about my routine of, you know, being up early in the morning, and I have both the Washington Post and the New York Times print editions delivered to my doorstep. And I know I'm a bit of a freak with that, but, you know, I dedicate time to reading. I think that they're really kind of living it kind of in real time all the time. They're not setting aside time to read news or things like that. They're always on social media. They're always interacting. And it's just kind of the way they breathe almost. And so it makes them, like I said, avid news consumers, but you know, from different sources. You know?
And those sources can be questionable at times, but that's true for every demographic. We can all come across some questionable materials these days.
Absolutely. We talked a lot about how to, you know, think through the sources that they're getting news from. If there's something out there, how is that information being attributed? Is it on the record? That's still the gold standard, right? That we should remember about as we kind of enter a new election season, for instance. Or is a lot of this just anonymous sourcing? And is it anonymous sourcing that doesn't explain why it's anonymous and doesn't necessarily explain maybe somebody's affiliation or why they might want to have said things? And basically, you know, are people just slinging around vendettas? I think, you know, it was helpful to talk to them about some media literacy.
You're in Kentucky for these visits. Right. Of course, you're in Cincinnati now for this interview, but you cover national politics for the Associated Press, and you're the editor there. And I'm wondering what you think of the recent election in Kentucky. We had a governor's race that went blue, whereas all the other statewide races went Republican. We've seen a lot of national analysis about what that might mean for those of us who live in Kentucky. I'm wondering, from the AP's perspective, what you think Kentucky's recent election might mean on the national stage?
Well, I think it fits into this broader trend that we've been talking about really since the midterms last year, that Republicans are beginning to really struggle in suburbs. And this is not a blip on the radar. It's not a race here or there. We saw it across the country last year in the midterms. That's how Democrats gained control of the House. We saw it here in Kentucky last week, where especially in areas of northern Kentucky around Louisville, those suburbs, places that have voted for Republican gubernatorial candidates in the past, did not do so this time. There was not only a higher turnout, but there was a higher turnout for the Democratic candidate. And that fits into what we're seeing, you know, in places like Virginia, where Democrats gain control of all levers of state government for the first time in a generation because of the turnout in suburban areas. We saw that in a special election in North Carolina earlier in the fall. It's happening over and over again. So I think Kentucky is kind of firmly in that trend now.
We're talking with Stephen Sloan. He's the AP National Political Editor. And Stephen, you're based in Washington, D.C., and you have to take a national view of the types of things that are taking place and how to report them. But the AP is really important locally as well, right? I mean, you're a feeder agency into a lot of media outlets. Can you talk about the influence that the Associated Press has in getting the daily news out?
Well, you're absolutely right, and it's one of the things that I love about the AP. We are not concentrated all in Washington or New York. We have reporters, and I think it's especially important and critical for political reporters. We are out in the communities where we live, where we're sending our kids to school. It is kind of part of our DNA, and that's how we're approaching the coming election. We have reporters who aren't just kind of diving into Iowa on the weekends. We have reporters who've lived in Iowa for decades and know everything that's gone on there, and not just in Iowa, but in places like Texas and places like Georgia, you know, and obviously Ohio and Kentucky. It's kind of a vital part of how we see ourselves and what we're going to bring to this coming election.
And how, as editor, do you make the decisions about where to dispatch reporters and what's important and what stories matter?
I think I listen to my reporters a lot. I think that's one of the nice things about having this footprint. You know, maybe I will be kind of part of the collective bubble in Washington, right? But I'll have a reporter, and this has happened, a reporter in Iowa, for instance. Tom Beaumont is our national political reporter in Iowa, and he's been there a long time and is terrific. And he was very early to point out Elizabeth Warren is doing well here this summer. He was early to point out Pete Buttigieg doing well this summer. It's really important for me to be listening to those voices and not just listening, but kind of mobilizing depending on what they say.
Political editor. it's quite a time for politics specifically.
A little busy.
Yeah, it seems like in a way, everything in the news is somehow political. Sports can be political. Entertainment can be political. How do you navigate these murky waters?
I mean, I like to say that the ball always bounces to us at some point where there's, you know, something happened, event happens, we kind of process that event, and then kind of, if it's not a head-on political story, it will become one. And so it's being prepared. It's kind of being, you know, smart about how you're going to do that. We also don't have to make everything political. Sometimes people will politicize an event or whatever. We don't have to jump at everything that is thrown to us. I think part of being an editor and part of being a leader in news is not just the stories that you do, but the stories that you, you know, it's not worth it. Right. And I think that's, you know, that's kind of how we go into those decisions.
Yeah, that's kind of what I was asking about, mm-hmm. I suppose, because there are news organizations that are looking for the type of story that might involve, you know, a national sports player who's won a championship deciding not to go to visit the White House. And
right.
The whole big stink can be made about that in certain corners of the media, mm-hmm. you know, consumers.
Right.
But for you.
Well, you can certainly include that in your story. You can talk about it. Does it need to be the lead of your story? Does it need to be the headline? It depends, you know, on the situation. But those are the editorial choices that that go into those conversations. We're not going to duck from, you know, the important issues facing the country, facing the candidates, facing voters. But it's, you know, it's all sometimes it can be a question of emphasis.
From your viewpoint, what's different about covering the current president than reading about or writing about presidents of the past?
Oh, how much time do we have?
About 4 minutes.
This is an extraordinary president who is doing, you know, who is breaking norms left and right, which is exactly what he said he would do when he was campaigning for this office. And he's doing it. And, you know, it has, you know, it's I'm sure, required changes in the way we do our job. But I also think that the job of journalism is the same today as it was 4 years ago, 5 years ago, 10 years ago, 20 years ago. We report the news as fairly and accurately as we can. When we get it wrong, which happens, we correct it. And we're going to do that for President Trump, and we'll do that, you know, as long as I'm in this business.
Well, what about the impact that this president, President Trump, has had on media coverage? He certainly attacks media, and we'll talk a little bit about fake news, but just his influence on the day-to-day news, it seems so much more disruptive than presidents of the past, because President Trump can change the whole narrative of a day with a single tweet, right? So how do you respond to that?
Well, I mean, if it's a tweet in which he's, you know, he has tweeted, I remember being at my desk and, you know, the tweet comes out that John Bolton is leaving, right? Those are moments that, okay, everybody is mobilizing, we're in breaking news mode. That is legitimate news, right? You know, I also think that we don't have to jump at every ball. We don't have to swing at every ball that comes our way. We can say, you know, okay, that's fine that happened. We don't have to, and I think that's something that a lot of journalists have really kind of come to the conclusion that, you know, you don't have to jump every time something happens. You can put things in context. I think that is something that we have really thought a lot about over the years, putting things into context, not only of the moment, but also in the arc of history. When we say, I think, you know, one of the words that we use a lot right now is unprecedented. Something, the president took an unprecedented action on whatever day. Sometimes it is legitimately unprecedented, and we need to explain why that's unprecedented. And we can also sometimes say, well, you know, not since this president 100 years ago did something, you know, have we been in that place? And I think, if anything, you know, in my experience, this time has required us to just be, to seek more context and not shorthand things, right? To tell readers why something is important or where it falls into the overall arc of our history.
What about the argument from someone like President Trump, who can reach all of his followers so directly at any time of day, mm-hmm. and he has really at just about any time of day? How do you shape the context that is often needed around a politician's words to frame it as, you know, maybe he didn't tell the truth, or maybe it was a little misleading? How are you able to get the people that he's reaching to read the proper journalistic approach to the story?
I mean, the AP, our stories go out everywhere, right? And are you know, online, in newspapers, you know, TV, you know, and when, you know, we will do things like say, you know, the president said something without evidence, without context, right? That's how we do it. We have to keep coming to do our jobs every day, right? And I think I'm not going to deny that things have changed, but the core conceit of what we do every day is still the same of truthful, objective, sober-minded journalism that informs our readers. And that was today, that was true then, today, and will continue to be so.
I think most journalists would agree with that. And they might also suggest that, you know, it's okay to have some fun every now and then. Of course, at one point, the president famously tweeted something that I think we pronounce kafefe,
yes,
which we had some fun with in our neck of the woods, because Covington, Kentucky is part of our listenership. And so a lot of little memes were made. And so that was fun. How do you handle those types of things? Is that something that the AP National Desk is going to touch when the president does something that is laughable, that even he gets in on the joke of?
You know, I have to remember what that moment was like. I might not have been at the AP at the time, actually, but we can have fun. We are fun people. We are delightful people to spend time with.
All fun people have to say, we are fun people.
I'm really fun. No, but it's true. And you know, so much of writing is tone, right? And, you know, you can do fun stories about the scene of Washington and Trump's Washington and, you know, the color that kind of comes into that. And we do that. It's not always a, you know, a super straight lead, and we should have fun with those moments, because these are the interesting moments along the course of this presidency, right? This will be something that we'll remember from this president.
For sure, certainly. And one other thing that we'll remember are these impeachment hearings that mm-hmm. are taking place. And being mm-hmm. based in Washington, as you are, Stephen Sloan, as the national political editor at the AP, what's it like there now?
I think that this is consuming a lot of attention in Washington. I mean, I think that we have to step back, and as we've kind of entered this phase, I've tried to do this for myself. You know, we've had so many extraordinary moments. I talked about how we kind of sometimes overuse the word unprecedented, but you know, impeachment proceedings have only happened to three other presidents in our country's history. It is a big deal, and you know, I think it's important to kind of note that this isn't something that just happens. And even we've had so many, you know, big hearings, right? Blockbuster hearings. Impeachment hearings are big. They're important.
Do you think that that's reflected in the consumers of news? Do you think that the seriousness of the issue is there for them? Or are we turning to our partisan outlets like usual?
I think a little bit of both. I think people are definitely finding affirmation sometimes rather than information, right? But I going back to my experiences at Northern Kentucky this week, you know, I asked students, are you paying attention to impeachment? And everybody said yes. So they might not be watching traditional news outlets. They might not be glued to their TV sets. They have these other things that they hold in their hands all day long. But they're paying attention. They're engaged.
And that's just it. Listeners of our show will know the political junkie, Ken Rudin. We do that once a month. And he and Howard Wilkinson, WVXU senior political analyst, will come on and we'll talk. And one thing that they've said a couple of times is that public opinion of impeachment may shift the way that it did back when Nixon was impeached and the hearings started and they were on television and people watched it. But the media landscape is so different from, you know, 1972, 73, and even different from 98, 99 when Bill Clinton was going through mm-hmm. this. So what type of influence is this larger, more diverse media landscape playing in the conversation about impeachment?
Well, I think that, you know, one of the concerns that has kind of come out of this era is that sometimes we just don't have an agreed upon set of facts anymore, right? And, you know, we're not all tuning into three networks at the end of the day. We have, you know, just a multitude of networks that have different vantage points. You know, the proliferation of information on the internet, on social media. It's there's just no kind of national coming together. That said, I do think that these moments are significant when broadcast TV breaks in as they have done during these impeachment hearings, and you don't have The View playing during the day.
You think even now that when NBC, CBS, and ABC, the traditional old school broadcast networks, break
is it to the degree that it was in the Nixon era? I don't know. That would be hard to imagine, right? But when they canceled, you know, I think that those are signals, right? This is important. We don't do this. We don't cancel The View and Rachel Ray.
Yeah.
Just for everybody, right? It's important. And it goes back to what I was saying, that impeachment hearings, even in these extraordinary times, this is significant.
It seemed that the Brett Kavanaugh hearings are somewhat similar in that mm-hmm. respect, in that all the networks were carrying these pretty extensively. And it seemed like for a moment, the country was paying attention and drawing their own conclusions.
I think that's absolutely true. I think that regardless of how they received that hearing, how that came to them, there is no doubt that that was kind of a touchstone moment in American political culture, and that continues to reverberate a year and change later. Yeah, absolutely.
I'm talking with Stephen Sloan. He's the AP national political editor based in Washington, D.C. He's in town visiting Northern Kentucky University, so we grabbed him for a quick interview. And I could not possibly let you go without talking about next year and presidential politics.
Is there something happening? I was going to take some vacations.
So just give me the general idea of how you are assigning that type of coverage. I mean, for us, you know, if a presidential candidate is coming into town, we can all mobilize for that one visit. But you've got a lot going on as the national political editor for this large system.
Well, look, we're 3 months out from Iowa, right? Less than 3 months out from Iowa, where the caucuses will usher in the nomination process. It is quite an undertaking every day. It's really exciting. We have reporters with candidates almost every day. More importantly, potentially, we have reporters talking to voters every day. And I think, you know, as I said, I kind of let in constant conversation, right, with these reporters who are deploying it, who are seeing things before I am in my fancy pants office in Washington, seeing it. And together we are, you know, trying to identify not only who's up and who's down there. You know, I think the horse race gets overplayed, certainly, but what are the issues that people are caring about? Is, you know, Medicare for All something that people want? Is, how is climate change coming into the equation for these Democratic voters? You know, do people want these big structural changes? Do they want more incremental changes that are done maybe with cooperation of Republicans?
Those are the questions. How are you explaining those things? Because, as these Democratic primary debates go on, you will hear one of the candidates, say Elizabeth Warren or Bernie Sanders, who push for Medicare for All, say, this is how much it's going to cost. And then there are other analyses that say, no, this is how much it's going to cost. What resources do you use as the Associated Press to say definitively, this is what we estimate something would possibly cost if this were implemented?
Well, we don't do our own independent estimates, but we do have experts in their field. So we have our political reporters, we have our policy reporters. So a great example recently, when Elizabeth Warren released her $20 trillion Medicare for All plan, we had a healthcare reporter in Washington who has analysts that he has been working with and knows for years and years and years, right? Who paired with a political reporter who not only delivered a story that looked at the political equation that was going on here with Elizabeth Warren, but whether that $20 trillion number was right, first of all, and then the revenue that she was talking about as options to pay for that, whether that added up. So that's how you do it. You pair policy reporters with political reporters. Hopefully, we don't live in such silos that that people who think about policy don't think about politics and vice versa. But, you know, I feel like I'm often scrounging around the newsroom, going around the newsroom, finding people to pair, right? And getting those conversations going. Yeah.
I don't think you'll have any shortage of content in the coming
months.
We'll
have a lot of work.
Stephen Sloan is the Associated Press national political editor, and he's been my guest here on Cincinnati Edition. Stephen, thanks so much for taking some time.
So good to be here. Thank you.
You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. The producer for today's show is Elise Meckler. The assistant producer is Selena Reeder. The technical director is Josh Elstro. You can find archives of our program online at wvxu.org. I'm Michael Monks.